Chapter 11. The Trial. Maslova Cross-Examined. When the reading of the indictment was over, the President, after having consulted the members, turned to Kartinkin, with an expression that plainly said, "Now we shall find out the whole truth down to the minutest detail." "Peasant Semyon Kartinkin," he said, stooping to the left. Semyon Kartinkin got up, stretched his arms down his sides, and, leaning forward with his whole body, continued moving his cheeks inaudibly.
"You are accused of having on the 17th of January, 1880, together with Euphemia Borchkova and Katerina Maslova, stolen money from a portmanteau belonging to the merchant Smelkov, and then, having procured some arsenic, persuaded Katerina Maslova to give it to the merchant Smelkov in a glass of brandy, which was the cause of Smelkov's death. Do you plead guilty?"
said the President, stooping to the right.
"Not nohow, because our business is to attend on the lodgers, and—"
"You'll tell us that afterwards. Do you plead guilty?"
"Oh, no, sir. I only—"
"You'll tell us that afterwards. Do you plead guilty?"
quietly and firmly asked the President.
"Can't do such a thing, because that—"
The usher again rushed up to Semyon Kartinkin and stopped him in a tragic whisper. The President moved the hand with which he held the paper and placed the elbow in a different position with an air that said, "This is finished," and turned to Euphemia Borchkova.
"Euphemia Borchkova, you are accused of having, on the 17th of January, 1880, in the lodging-house Mauritania, together with Semyon Kartinkin and Katerina Maslova, stolen some money and a ring out of the merchant Smelkov's portmanteau, and, having shared the money among yourselves, given poison to the merchant Smelkov, thereby causing his death. Do you plead guilty?"
"I am not guilty of anything,"
boldly and firmly replied the prisoner.
"I never went near the room, but when this baggage went in, she did the whole business."
"You will say all this afterwards,"
the President again said quietly and firmly.
"So you do not plead guilty?"
"I did not take the money, nor give the drink, nor go into the room. Had I gone in, I should have kicked her out."
"So you do not plead guilty?"
"Never." Very well.
"Katerina Maslova,"
the President began, turning to the third prisoner,
"you are accused of having come from the brothel with the key of the merchant Smelkov's portmanteau, money, and a ring."
He said all this like a lesson learned by heart, leaning towards the member on his left, who was whispering into his ear that a bottle mentioned in the list of the material evidence was missing.
"Of having stolen out of the portmanteau money and a ring,"
he repeated,
"and shared it. Then, returning to the lodging-house Mauritania with Smelkov, of giving him poison in his drink and thereby causing his death. Do you plead guilty?"
"I'm not guilty of anything," she began rapidly. "As I said before, I say again, I did not take it. I did not take it. I did not take anything, and the ring he gave me himself."
"You do not plead guilty of having stolen 2,500 rubles?
Asked the President.
"I've said I took nothing but the 40 rubles.
"Well, and do you plead guilty of having given the merchant Smelkov a powder in his drink?"
"Yes, that I did. Only I believed what they told me, that they were sleeping powders, and that no harm could come of them. I never thought, and never wished. God is my witness. I say I never meant this," she said.
"So you do not plead guilty of having stolen the money and the ring from the merchant Smelkov, but confess that you gave him the powder?"
said the President.
"Well, yes, I do confess this. But I thought they were sleeping powders. I only gave them to make him sleep. I never meant and never thought of worse."
"Very well,"
said the President, evidently satisfied with the results gained.
"Now tell us how it all happened."
And he leaned back in his chair and put his folded hands on the table.
"Tell us all about it. A free and full confession will be to your advantage."
Maslova continued to look at the President in silence and blushing.
Tell us how it happened.
How it happened?
Maslova suddenly began, speaking quickly. I came to the lodging house and was shown into the room.
He was there, already very drunk.
She pronounced the word he with a look of horror in her wide-open eyes.
I wished to go away, but he would not let me.
She stopped, as if having lost the thread or remembered something else.
Well, and then?
Well, what then? I remained a bit and went home again.
At this moment the public prosecutor raised himself a little, leaning on one elbow in an awkward manner.
You would like to put a question?
Said the president, and having received an answer in the affirmative, he made a gesture inviting the public prosecutor to speak.
I want to ask, was the prisoner previously acquainted with Semyon Kartinkin?
Said the public prosecutor, without looking at Maslova, and having put the question, he compressed his lips and frowned. The president repeated the question. Maslova stared at the public prosecutor with a frightened look.
With Semyon?
Yes, she said.
I should like to know what the prisoner's acquaintance with Kartinkin consisted in. Did they meet often?
Consisted in? He invited me for the lodgers. It was not an acquaintance at all, answered Maslova,
anxiously moving her eyes from the president to the public prosecutor and back to the president.
I should like to know why Kartinkin invited only Maslova and none of the other girls for the lodgers,
said the public prosecutor, with half-closed eyes and a cunning Mephistophelian smile.
I don't know. How should I know?
Said Maslova, casting a frightened look round and fixing her eyes for a moment on Nekhludov.
He asked whom he liked.
Is it possible that she has recognized me? Thought Nekhludov, and the blood rushed to his face, but Maslova turned away without distinguishing him from the others, and again fixed her eyes anxiously on the public prosecutor.
So the prisoner denies having had any intimate relations with Kartinkin? Very well, I have no more questions to ask.
And the public prosecutor took his elbow off the desk and began writing something. He was not really noting anything down, but only going over the letters of his notes with a pen. Having seen the procureur and leading advocates, after putting a clever question, make a note, with which, later on, to annihilate their adversaries. The president did not continue at once, because he was consulting the member with the spectacles, whether he was agreed that the questions, which had all been prepared beforehand and written out, should be put.
"Well, what happened next?"
he then went on.
"I came home,"
looking a little more boldly only at the president,
"and went to bed. Hardly had I fallen asleep when one of our girls, Berthe, woke me. Go, your merchant has come again.
She again uttered the word he with evident horror.
"He kept treating our girls, and then wanted to send for more wine, but his money was all gone, and he sent me to his lodgings and told me where the money was and how much to take, so I went."
The president was whispering to the member on his left, but in order to appear as if he had heard, he repeated her last words.
"So you went. Well, what next?"
"I went, and did all he told me. Went into his room. I did not go alone, but called Semyon Kartinkin and her," she said, pointing to Borchkova.
"That's a lie. I never went in,"
Borchkova began, but was stopped.
"In their presence I took out 4 notes," continued Maslova, frowning, without looking at Borchkova.
"Yes, but did the prisoner notice," again asked the prosecutor, "how much money there was when she was getting out the 40 roubles?"
Maslova shuddered when the prosecutor addressed her. She did not know why it was, but she felt that he wished her evil.
"I did not count it, but only saw some 100 rouble notes."
"Ah, the prisoner saw 100 rouble notes. That's all?"
"Well, so you brought back the money,"
continued the president, looking at the clock.
"I did."
"Well, and then?"
"Then he took me back with him," said Maslova.
"Well, and how did you give him the powder in his drink?"
"How did I give it? I put them in and gave it him."
"Why did you give it him?"
She did not answer, but sighed deeply and heavily.
"He would not let me go," she said, after a moment's silence, "and I was quite tired out. And so I went out into the passage and said to Semyon, 'If he would only let me go, I am so tired.' And he said, 'We are also sick of him. "'We were thinking of giving him a sleeping draught. "'He will fall asleep, and then you can go.' "'So I said, all right. "'I thought they were harmless, and he gave me the packet. "'I went in. "'He was lying behind the partition, and at once called for brandy. "'I took a bottle of fine champagne from the table, "'poured out two glasses, one for him and one for myself, "'and put the powders into his glass and gave it him. "'Had I known, how could I have given them to him?'
"'Well, and how did the ring come into your possession?'
asked the president.
"'When did he give it to you?'
"'That was when we came back to his lodgings. "'I wanted to go away, and he gave me a knock on the head and broke my comb. "'I got angry and said I'd go away, and he took the ring off his finger "'and gave it to me so that I should not go,' she said.
"'Then the public prosecutor again slightly raised himself "'and, putting on an air of simplicity, asked permission to put a few more questions, "'and, having received it, bending his head over his embroidered collar, he said,
"'I should like to know how long the prisoner remained in the merchant Smelkov's room.'
Maslova again seemed frightened, and she again looked anxiously from the public prosecutor to the president, and said hurriedly,
"'I do not remember how long.'
"'Yes, but does the prisoner remember if she went anywhere else in the lodging-house after she left Smelkov?'
Maslova considered for a moment.
"'Yes, I did go into an empty room next to his.
"'Yes, and why did you go in?'
asked the public prosecutor, forgetting himself and addressing her directly.
"'I went in to rest a bit, and to wait for an izvochik.
"'And was Kartinkin in the room with the prisoner or not?'
"'He came in.
"'Why did he come in?'
"'There was some of the merchant's brandy left, and we finished it together.'
"'Oh, finished it together. "'Very well. And did the prisoner talk to Kartinkin, and if so, what about?'
Maslova suddenly frowned, blushed very red, and said hurriedly,
"'What about? "'I did not talk about anything, and that's all I know. "'Do what you like with me. "'I'm not guilty, and that's all.'
"'I have nothing more to ask,' said the prosecutor,
and drawing up his shoulders in an unnatural manner, began writing down, as the prisoner's own evidence, in the notes for his speech, that she had been in the empty room with Kartinkin. There was a short silence.
"'You have nothing more to say?'
"'I have told everything,' she said with a sigh, and sat down.
Then the president noted something down, and having listened to something that the member on his left whispered to him, he announced a 10 minutes interval, rose hurriedly, and left the court. The communication he had received from the tall, bearded member with the kindly eyes was that the member, having felt a slight stomach derangement, wished to do a little massage and to take some drops. And this was why an interval was made. When the judges had risen, the advocates, the jury, and the witnesses also rose, with the pleasant feeling that part of the business was finished, and began moving in different directions. Nekhludov went into the jury's room and sat down by the window. Chapter 12 12 years before. Yes, this was Katyusha. The relations between Nekhludov and Katyusha had been the following. Nekhludov first saw Katyusha when he was a student in his 3rd year at the university, and was preparing an essay on land tenure during the summer vacation, which he passed with his aunts. Until then he had always lived in summer with his mother and sister on his mother's large estate near Moscow. But that year his sister had married, and his mother had gone abroad to a watering place, and he, having his essay to write, resolved to spend the summer with his aunts. It was very quiet in their secluded estate, and there was nothing to distract his mind. His aunts loved their nephew and heir very tenderly, and he, too, was fond of them, and of their simple, old-fashioned life. During that summer on his aunt's estate, Nekhludov passed through that blissful state of existence when a young man for the first time, without guidance from anyone outside, realizes all the beauty and significance of life, and the importance of the task allotted in it to man. When he grasps the possibility of unlimited advance towards perfection for one's self and for all the world, and gives himself to this task, not only hopefully, but with full conviction of attaining to the perfection he imagines. In that year, while still at the university, he had read Spencer's Social Statics, and Spencer's views on landholding especially impressed him, as he himself was heir to large estates. His father had not been rich, but his mother had received 10,000 acres of land for her dowry. At that time, he fully realized all the cruelty and injustice of private property in land, and being one of those to whom a sacrifice to the demands of conscience gives the highest spiritual enjoyment, he decided not to retain property rights, but to give up to the peasant laborers the land he had inherited from his father. It was on this land question he wrote his essay. He arranged his life on his aunt's estate in the following manner. He got up very early, sometimes at 3 o'clock, and before sunrise went through the morning mists to bathe in the river under the hill. He returned while the dew still lay on the grass and the flowers. Sometimes, having finished his coffee, he sat down with his books of reference and his papers to write his essay, but very often, instead of reading or writing, he left home again and wandered through the fields and the woods. Before dinner he lay down and slept somewhere in the garden. At dinner he amused and entertained his aunts with his bright spirits. Then he rode on horseback, or went for a row on the river, and in the evening he again worked at his essay, or sat reading or playing patience with his aunts. His joy in life was so great that it agitated him, and kept him awake many a night, especially when it was moonlight, so that instead of sleeping he wandered about in the garden till dawn, alone with his dreams and fancies. And so, peacefully and happily, he lived through the first month of his stay with his aunts, taking no particular notice of their half-ward, half-servant, the black-eyed, quick-footed Katyusha. Then, at the age of 19, Nekhludov, brought up under his mother's wing, was still quite pure. If a woman figured in his dreams at all, it was only as a wife. All the other women, who, according to his ideas, he could not marry, were not women for him, but human beings. But on Ascension Day that summer, a neighbour of his aunt's and her family, consisting of 2 young daughters, a schoolboy, and a young artist of peasant origin who was staying with them, came to spend the day. After tea they all went to play in the meadow in front of the house, where the grass had already been mown. They played at the game of Gorielki, and Katyusha joined them, running about and changing partners several times. Nekhludov caught Katyusha, and she became his partner. Up to this time he had liked Katyusha's looks, but the possibility of any nearer relations with her had never entered his mind. "Impossible to catch those two," said the merry young artist, whose turn it was to catch, and who could run very fast with his short, muscular legs.
"You, and not catch us," said Katyusha.
"One, two, three," and the artist clapped his hands. Katyusha, hardly restraining her laughter, changed places with Nekhludov behind the artist's back, and pressing his large hand with her little rough one and rustling with her starched petticoat, ran to the left. Nekhludov ran fast to the right, trying to escape from the artist, but when he looked round he saw the artist running after Katyusha, who kept well ahead, her firm young legs moving rapidly. There was a lilac bush in front of them, and Katyusha made a sign with her head to Nekhludov to join her behind it, for if they once clasped hands again they were safe from their pursuer, that being a rule of the game. He understood the sign and ran behind the bush, but he did not know that there was a small ditch overgrown with nettles there. He stumbled and fell into the nettles, already wet with dew, stinging his hands, but rose immediately, laughing at his mishap. Katyusha, with her eyes black as sloes, her face radiant with joy, was flying towards him, and they caught hold of each other's hands.
"Got stung, I dare say," she said, arranging her hair with her free hand, breathing fast and looking straight up at him with a glad, pleasant smile.
"I did not know there was a ditch here," he answered, smiling also and keeping her hand in his. She drew nearer to him, and he himself, not knowing how it happened, stooped towards her. She did not move away, and he pressed her hand tight and kissed her on the lips.
"There, you've done it," she said, and freeing her hand with a swift movement, ran away from him.
Then, breaking 2 branches of white lilac from which the blossoms were already falling, she began fanning her hot face with them. Then, with her head turned back to him, she walked away, swaying her arms briskly in front of her, and joined the other players. After this there grew up between Nekhludov and Katyusha those peculiar relations which often exist between a pure young man and girl who are attracted to each other. When Katyusha came into the room, or even when he saw her white apron from afar, everything brightened up in Nekhludov's eyes.
as when the sun appears, everything becomes more interesting, more joyful, more important. The whole of life seemed full of gladness, and she felt the same. But it was not only Katyusha's presence that had this effect on Nyakhludov. The mere thought that Katyusha existed, and for her that Nyakhludov existed, had this effect. When he received an unpleasant letter from his mother, or could not get on with his essay, or felt the unreasoning sadness that young people are often subject to, he had only to remember Katyusha and that he should see her, and it all vanished. Katyusha had much work to do in the house, but she managed to get a little leisure for reading, and Nyakhludov gave her Dostoevsky and Turgenev, whom he had just read himself, to read. She liked Turgenev's Lull best. They had talks at moments snatched when meeting in the passage, on the veranda or the yard, and sometimes in the room of his aunt's old servant, Matryona Pavlovna, with whom he sometimes used to drink tea, and where Katyusha used to work. These talks in Matryona Pavlovna's presence were the pleasantest. When they were alone, it was worse. Their eyes at once began to say something very different and far more important than what their mouths uttered. Their lips puckered, and they felt a kind of dread of something that made them part quickly. These relations continued between Nyakhludov and Katyusha during the whole time of his first visit to his aunt's. They noticed it and became frightened, and even wrote to Princess Elena Ivanovna, Nyakhludov's mother. His aunt, Mary Ivanovna, was afraid Dmitri would form an intimacy with Katyusha. But her fears were groundless, for Nyakhludov, himself hardly conscious of it, loved Katyusha, loved her as the pure love, and therein lay his safety, his and hers. He not only did not feel any desire to possess her, but the very thought of it filled him with horror. The fears of the more poetical Sofia Ivanovna, that Dmitri, with his thoroughgoing, resolute character, having fallen in love with a girl, might make up his mind to marry her, without considering either her birth or her station, had more ground. Had Nyakhludov at that time been conscious of his love for Katyusha, and especially if he had been told that he could on no account join his life with that of a girl in her position, it might have easily happened that, with his usual straightforwardness, he would have come to the conclusion that there could be no possible reason for him not to marry any girl whatever, as long as he loved her. But his aunts did not mention their fears to him, and, when he left, he was still unconscious of his love for Katyusha. He was sure that what he felt for Katyusha was only one of the manifestations of the joy of life that filled his whole being, and that this sweet, merry little girl shared this joy with him. Yet when he was going away, and Katyusha stood with his aunts in the porch and looked after him, her dark, slightly squinting eyes filled with tears. He felt, after all, that he was leaving something beautiful, precious, something which would never reoccur. And he grew very sad. "Goodbye, Katyusha," he said, looking across Sofia Ivanovna's cap as he was getting into the trap. "Thank you for everything."
"Goodbye, Dmitri Ivanovitch," she said, with her pleasant, tender voice, keeping back the tears that filled her eyes, and ran away into the hall, where she could cry in peace. Chapter 13. Life in the Army.
After that, Nyakhludov did not see Katyusha for more than 3 years. When he saw her again, he had just been promoted to the rank of officer and was going to join his regiment. On the way he came to spend a few days with his aunts, being now a very different young man from the one who had spent the summer with them 3 years before. He then had been an honest, unselfish lad, ready to sacrifice himself for any good cause. Now he was depraved and selfish and thought only of his own enjoyment. Then God's world seemed a mystery which he tried enthusiastically and joyfully to solve. Now everything in life seemed clear and simple, defined by the conditions of the life he was leading. Then he had felt the importance of, and had need of, intercourse with nature, and with those who had lived and thought and felt before him, philosophers and poets. What he now considered necessary and important were human institutions and intercourse with his comrades. Then women seemed mysterious and charming. charming by the very mystery that enveloped them. Now the purpose of women, all women except those of his own family and the wives of his friends, was a very definite one. Women were the best means towards an already experienced enjoyment. Then money was not needed, and he did not require even one-third of what his mother allowed him. But now this allowance of 1,500 rubles a month did not suffice, and he had already had some unpleasant talks about it with his mother. Then he had looked on his spirit as the eye. Now it was his healthy, strong animal eye that he looked upon as himself. And all this terrible change had come about because he had ceased to believe himself and had taken to believing others. This he had done because it was too difficult to live believing one's self. Believing one's self, one had to decide every question not in favour of one's own animal life, which is always seeking for easy gratifications, but almost in every case against it. Believing others, there was nothing to decide. Everything had been decided already, and decided always in favour of the animal eye and against the spiritual. Nor was this all. Believing in his own self, he was always exposing himself to the censure of those around him. Believing others, he had their approval. So when Nekhludov had talked of the serious matters of life, of God, truth, riches, and poverty, all round him thought it out of place, and even rather funny. And his mother and aunts called him, with kindly irony, notre cher philosophe. But when he read novels, told improper anecdotes, went to see funny vaudevilles in the French theatre, and gaily repeated the jokes, everyone admired and encouraged him. When he considered it right to limit his needs, wore an old overcoat, took no wine, everybody thought it strange and looked upon it as a kind of showing off. But when he spent large sums on hunting or on furnishing a peculiar and luxurious study for himself, everybody admired his taste and gave him expensive presents to encourage his hobby. While he kept pure and meant to remain so till he married, his friends prayed for his health, and even his mother was not grieved but rather pleased when she found out that he had become a real man and had gained over some French woman from his friend. As to the episode with Katyusha, the princess could not without horror think that he might possibly have married her. In the same way, when Nekhludov came of age and gave the small estate he had inherited from his father to the peasants, because he considered the holding of private property in land wrong, this step filled his mother and relations with dismay, and served as an excuse for making fun of him to all his relatives. He was continually told that these peasants, after they had received the land, got no richer, but on the contrary poorer, having opened 3 public houses and left off doing any work. But when Nekhludov entered the guards and spent and gambled away so much with his aristocratic companions that Elena Ivanovna, his mother, had to draw on her capital, she was hardly pained, considering it quite natural and even good that wild oats should be sown at an early age and in good company, as her son was doing. At first Nekhludov struggled, but all that he had considered good while he had faith in himself was considered bad by others, and what he had considered evil was looked upon as good by those among whom he lived, and the struggle grew too hard. And at last Nekhludov gave in, i.e., left off believing himself and began believing others. At first this giving up of faith in himself was unpleasant, but it did not long continue to be so. At that time he acquired the habit of smoking and drinking wine, and soon got over this unpleasant feeling, and even felt great relief. Nekhludov, with his passionate nature, gave himself thoroughly to the new way of life so approved of by all those around, and he entirely stifled the inner voice which demanded something different. This began after he moved to St. Petersburg, and reached its highest point when he entered the army. Military life, in general, depraves men. It places them in conditions of complete idleness, i.e., absence of all useful work, frees them of their common human duties, which it replaces by merely conventional ones to the honour of the regiment, the uniform, the flag, and while giving them on the one hand absolute power over other men, also puts them into conditions of servile obedience to those of higher rank than themselves. But when, to the usual depraving influence of military service with its honours, uniforms, flags, its permitted violence and murder, there is added the depraving influence of riches and nearness to and intercourse with members of the imperial family, as is the case in the chosen regiment of the guards in which all the officers are rich and of good family, then this depraving influence creates in the men who succumb to it a perfect mania of selfishness. And this mania of selfishness attacked Nekhludov from the moment he entered the army and began living in the way his companions lived. He had no occupation whatever except to dress in a uniform splendidly made and well brushed by other people, and with arms also made and cleaned and handed to him by others, ride to reviews on a fine horse which had been bred, broken in, and fed by others. There, with other men like himself, he had to wave a sword, shoot off guns, and teach others to do the same. He had no other work, and the highly placed persons, young and old, the Tsar and those near him, not only sanctioned his occupation, but praised and thanked him for it. After this was done, it was thought important to eat, and particularly to drink, in officers' clubs or the salons of the best restaurants, squandering large sums of money which came from some invisible source. Then theatres, ballets, women, then again riding on horseback, waving of swords and shooting, and again the squandering of money, the wine, cards, and women. This kind of life acts on military men even more depravingly than on others, because if any other than a military man led such a life, he cannot help being ashamed of it in the depth of his heart. A military man is, on the contrary, proud of a life of this kind, especially at wartime, and Nekhludov had entered the army just after war, where the Turks had been declared. "We are prepared to sacrifice our lives at the wars, and therefore a gay, reckless life is not only pardonable, but absolutely necessary for us, and so we lead it." Such were Nekhludov's confused thoughts at this period of his existence, and he felt all the time the delight of being free of the moral barriers he had formerly set himself, and the state he lived in was that of a chronic mania of selfishness. He was in this state when, after 3 years' absence, he came again to visit his aunts. Chapter 14. The Second Meeting with Maslova. Nekhludov went to visit his aunts because their estate lay near the road he had to travel in order to join his regiment, which had gone forward, because they had very warmly asked him to come, and especially because he wanted to see Katyusha. Perhaps in his heart he had already formed those evil designs against Katyusha which his now uncontrolled animal self suggested to him, but he did not acknowledge this as his intention, but only wished to go back to the spot where he had been so happy, to see his rather funny but dear, kind-hearted old aunts, who always, without his noticing it, surrounded him with an atmosphere of love and admiration, and to see sweet Katyusha, of whom he had retained so pleasant a memory. He arrived at the end of March, on Good Friday, after the thaw had set in. It was pouring with rain, so that he had not a dry thread on him and was feeling very cold, but yet vigorous and full of spirits, as always at that time. "Is she still with them?" he thought, as he drove into the familiar old-fashioned courtyard, surrounded by a low brick wall, and now filled with snow off the roofs. He expected she would come out when she heard the sledge bells, but she did not. Two barefooted women with pails and tucked-up skirts, who had evidently been scrubbing the floors, came out of the side door. She was not at the front door either, and only Tikhon, the manservant with his apron on, evidently also busy cleaning, came out into the front porch. His aunt, Sofia Ivanovna, alone met him in the anteroom. She had a silk dress on and a cap on her head. Both aunts had been to church and had received communion.
"Well, this is nice of you to come," said Sofia Ivanovna, kissing him. "Mary is not well, got tired in church. We have been to communion."
"I congratulate you, Aunt Sofia," said Nekhludov, kissing Sofia Ivanovna's hand.
"Oh, I beg your pardon, I have made you wet." "Go to your room. Why, you are soaking wet. Dear me, you have got moustaches. Katyusha, Katyusha, get him some coffee, be quick." "Directly," came the sound of a well-known, pleasant voice from the passage, and Nekhludov's heart cried out, "She's here!" And it was as if the sun had come out from behind the clouds. Nekhludov, followed by Tikhon, went gaily to his old room to change his things. He felt inclined to ask Tikhon about Katyusha, how she was, what she was doing. Was she not going to be married? But Tikhon was so respectful and at the same time so severe,
insisted so firmly on pouring the water out of the jug for him that Nekhludov could not make up his mind to ask him about Katyusha, but only inquired about Tikhon's grandsons, about the old so-called brother's horse, and about the dog Polkan. All were alive, except Polkan, who had gone mad the summer before. When he had taken off all his wet things and just begun to dress again, Nekhludov heard quick, familiar footsteps and a knock at the door. Nekhludov knew the steps, and also the knock. No one but she walked and knocked like that. Having thrown his wet greatcoat over his shoulders, he opened the door. "Come in." It was she, Katyusha, the same, only sweeter than before. The slightly squinting, naive black eyes looked up in the same old way. Now, as then, she had on a white apron. She brought him from his aunt's a piece of scented soap, with the wrapper just taken off, and two towels, one a long Russian-embroidered one, the other a bath towel. The unused soap, with the stamped inscription, the towels, and her own self, all were equally clean, fresh, undefiled, and pleasant. The irrepressible smile of joy at the sight of him made the sweet, firm lips pucker up as of old.
"How do you do, Dmitri Ivanovitch?" she uttered with difficulty, her face suffused with a rosy blush.
"Good morning. How do you do?" he said, also blushing. "Alive and well?"
"Yes, the Lord be thanked. And here is your favourite pink soap and towels from your aunt's," she said, putting the soap on the table and hanging the towels over the back of a chair.
"There is everything here," said Tikhon,
defending the visitor's independence and pointing to Nekhludov's open dressing-case, filled with brushes, perfumes, fixatoire, a great many bottles with silver lids and all sorts of toilet appliances. "Thank my aunt, please."
"Oh, how glad I am to be here," said Nekhludov, his heart filling with light and tenderness as of old.
She only smiled in answer to these words and went out. The aunts, who had always loved Nekhludov, welcomed him this time more warmly than ever. Dmitri was going to the war, where he might be wounded or killed, and this touched the old aunts. Nekhludov had arranged to stay only a day and night with his aunts, but when he had seen Katyusha, he agreed to stay over Easter with them, and telegraphed to his friend Schonbock, whom he was to have joined in Odessa, that he should come and meet him at his aunt's instead. As soon as he had seen Katyusha, Nekhludov's old feelings toward her awoke again. Now, just as then, he could not see her white apron without getting excited. He could not listen to her steps, her voice, her laugh, without a feeling of joy. He could not look at her eyes, black as sloes, without a feeling of tenderness, especially when she smiled. And, above all, he could not notice without agitation how she blushed when they met. He felt he was in love, but not as before, when this love was a kind of mystery to him, and he would not own even to himself that he loved, and when he was persuaded that one could love only once. Now he knew he was in love and was glad of it, and knew dimly what this love consisted of, and what it might lead to, though he sought to conceal it even from himself. In Nekhludov, as in every man, there were two beings. One, the spiritual, seeking only that kind of happiness for himself which should tend towards the happiness of all. The other, the animal man, seeking only his own happiness, and ready to sacrifice to it the happiness of the rest of the world. At this period of his mania of self-love, brought on by life in Petersburg and in the army, this animal man ruled supreme, and completely crushed the spiritual man in him. But when he saw Katyusha and experienced the same feelings as he had 3 years before, the spiritual man in him raised its head once more and began to assert its rights. And up to Easter, during 2 whole days, an unconscious, ceaseless inner struggle went on in him. He knew in the depths of his soul that he ought to go away, that there was no real reason for staying on with his aunts, knew that no good could come of it. And yet it was so pleasant, so delightful, that he did not honestly acknowledge the fact to himself and stayed on. On Easter Eve, the priest and the deacon who came to the house to say Mass had had, so they said, the greatest difficulty in getting over the 3 miles that lay between the church and the old lady's house, coming across the puddles and the bare earth in a sledge. Nekhludov attended the Mass with his aunts and the servants, and kept looking at Katyusha, who was near the door and brought in the censers for the priests.
Then, having given the priests and his aunts the Easter kiss, though it was not midnight and therefore not Easter yet, he was already going to bed when he heard the old servant, Matryona Pavlovna, preparing to go to the church to get the kulich and paski, Easter cakes, blessed after the midnight service. "I shall go too," he thought. The road to the church was impassable either in a sledge or on wheels, so Nekhludov, who behaved in his aunt's house just as he did at home, ordered the old horse, the brother's horse, to be saddled, and instead of going to bed he put on his gay uniform, a pair of tight-fitting riding breeches and his overcoat, and got on the old overfed and heavy horse, which neighed continually all the way as he rode in the dark through the puddles and snow to the church. Chapter 15. The Early Mass. For Nekhludov, this early Mass remained forever after one of the brightest and most vivid memories of his life. When he rode out of the darkness, broken only here and there by patches of white snow, into the churchyard illuminated by a row of lamps around the church, the service had already begun. The peasants, recognizing Mary Ivanovna's nephew, led his horse, which was pricking up its ears at the sight of the lights, to a dry place where he could get off, put it up for him, and showed him into the church, which was full of people. On the right stood the peasants, the old men in homespun coats and clean white linen bands wrapped round their legs, the young men in new cloth coats, bright-coloured belts round their waists and top boots. On the left stood the women with red silk kerchiefs on their heads, black velveteen sleeveless jackets, bright red shirt sleeves, gay-coloured green, blue and red skirts, and thick leather boots. The old women, dressed more quietly, stood behind them with white kerchiefs, homespun coats, old-fashioned skirts of dark homespun material, and shoes on their feet. Gaily dressed children, their hair well oiled, went in and out among them. The men, making the sign of the cross, bowed down and raised their heads again, shaking back their hair. The women, especially the old ones, fixed their eyes on an icon surrounded with candles, and made the sign of the cross, firmly pressing their folded fingers to the kerchief on their foreheads, to their shoulders, and their stomachs, and whispering something, stooped or knelt down. The children, imitating the grown-up people, prayed earnestly when they knew that they were being observed. The gilt case containing the icon glittered, illuminated on all sides by tall candles ornamented with golden spirals. The candelabra was filled with tapers, and from the choir sounded most merry tunes sung by amateur choristers, with bellowing bass and shrill boys' voices among them. Nekhludov passed up to the front. In the middle of the church stood the aristocracy of the place, a landed proprietor with his wife and son, the latter dressed in a sailor's suit, the police officer, the telegraph clerk, a tradesman in top boots, and the village elder with a medal on his breast, and to the right of the ambo, just behind the landed proprietor's wife, stood Matryona Pavlovna, in a lilac dress and fringed shawl, and Katyusha, in a white dress with a tucked bodice, blue sash, and red bow in her black hair. Everything seemed festive, solemn, bright, and beautiful. The priest in his silver cloth vestments with gold crosses, the deacon, the clerk, and chanter in their silver and gold surplices, the amateur choristers in their best clothes with their well-oiled hair, the merry tunes of the holiday hymns that sounded like dance music, and the continual blessing of the people by the priests, who held candles decorated with flowers, and repeated the cry of, "Christ is risen, Christ is risen." All was beautiful, but above all, Katyusha, in her white dress, blue sash, and the red bow on her black head, her eyes beaming with rapture. Nekhludov knew that she felt his presence without looking at him. He noticed this as he passed her, walking up to the altar. He had nothing to tell her, but he invented something to say and whispered as he passed her, "Aunt told me that she would break her fast after the late Mass." The young blood rushed up to Katyusha's sweet face, as it always did when she looked at him. The black eyes, laughing and full of joy, gazed naively up and remained fixed on Nekhludov. "I know," she said, with a smile. At this moment the clerk was going out with a copper coffee-pot of holy water in his hand, and, not noticing Katyusha, brushed her with his surplice. Evidently he brushed against Katyusha through wishing to pass Nekhludov at a respectful distance, and Nekhludov was surprised that he, the clerk, did not understand that everything here, yes, and in all the world, only existed for Katyusha, and that everything else might remain unheeded, only not she, because she was the centre of all. For her the gold glittered round the icons. For her all these candles in candelabra and candlesticks were alight. For her were sung these joyful hymns, "Behold the Passover of the Lord! Rejoice, O ye people!" All that was good in the world was for her. And it seemed to him that Katyusha was aware that it was all for her when he looked at her well-shaped figure, the tucked white dress, the rapt, joyous expression on her face, by which he knew that just exactly the same that was singing in his own soul was also singing in hers. In the interval between the early and the late Mass, Nekhludov left the church. The people stood aside to let him pass, and bowed. Some knew him, others asked who he was. He stopped on the steps. The beggars standing there came clamouring round him, and he gave them all the change he had in his purse and went down. It was dawning, but the sun had not yet risen. The people grouped round the graves in the churchyard. Katyusha had remained inside. Nekhludov stood waiting for her. The people continued coming out, clattering with their nailed boots on the stone steps and dispersing over the churchyard. A very old man with shaking head, his aunt's cook, stopped Nekhludov in order to give him the Easter kiss. His old wife took an egg, dyed yellow, out of her handkerchief, and gave it to Nekhludov, and a smiling young peasant in a new coat and green belt also came up. "Christ is risen," he said, with laughing eyes, and coming close to Nekhludov, he enveloped him in his peculiar but pleasant peasant smell, and, tickling him with his curly beard, kissed him 3 times, straight on the mouth, with his firm, fresh lips. While the peasant was kissing Nekhludov and giving him a dark brown egg, the lilac dress of Matryona Pavlovna and the dear black head with the red bow appeared. Katyusha caught sight of him over the heads of those in front of her, and he saw how her face brightened up. She had come out with Matryona Pavlovna onto the porch and stopped there distributing alms to the beggars. A beggar with a red scab in place of a nose came up to Katyusha. She gave him something, drew nearer him, and, evincing no sign of disgust, but her eyes still shining with joy, kissed him 3 times. And while she was doing this, her eyes met Nekhludov's with a look as if she were asking, "Is this that I am doing right?" "Yes, dear, yes, it is right. Everything is right. Everything is beautiful. I love." They came down the steps of the porch, and he came up to them. He did not mean to give them the Easter kiss, but only to be nearer to her. Matryona Pavlovna bowed her head and said with a smile, "Christ is risen," and her tone implied, "Today we are all equal." She wiped her mouth with her handkerchief rolled into a ball and stretched her lips towards him. "He is indeed," answered Nekhludov, kissing her. Then he looked at Katyusha. She blushed and drew nearer.
"Christ is risen, Dmitri Ivanovitch."
"He is risen indeed," answered Nekhludov. And they kissed twice, then paused as if considering whether a third kiss were necessary, and having decided that it was, kissed a third time, and smiled.
"You are going to the priest's?" asked Nekhludov.
"No. We shall sit out here a bit, Dmitri Ivanovitch," said Katyusha with effort, as if she had accomplished some joyous task, and her whole chest heaving with a deep sigh, she looked straight in his face with a look of devotion, virgin purity and love in her very slightly squinting eyes. In the love between a man and a woman there always comes a moment when this love has reached its zenith, a moment when it is unconscious, unreasoning, and with nothing sensual about it. Such a moment had come for Nekhludov on that Easter Eve, when he brought Katyusha back to his mind. Now, this moment veiled all else. The smooth, glossy black head, the white tucked dress closely fitting her graceful maidenly form, her as yet undeveloped bosom, the blushing cheeks, the tender, shining black eyes with their slight squint heightened by the sleepless night, and her whole being stamped with those 2 marked features— purity
and chaste love. Love not only for him, he knew that, but for everybody and everything. Not for the good alone, but for all that is in the world, even for that beggar whom she had kissed. He knew she had that love in her, because on that night and morning he was conscious of it in himself, and conscious that in this love he became one with her. Ah, if it had all stopped there, at the point it had reached that night. Yes, all that horrible business had not yet happened on that Easter Eve, he thought, as he sat by the window of the jurymen's room. Chapter 16. The First Step. When he returned from church, Nekhludov broke the fast with his aunts and took a glass of spirits and some wine, having got into that habit while with his regiment, and when he reached his room, fell asleep at once, dressed as he was. He was awakened by a knock at the door. He knew it was her knock, and got up, rubbing his eyes and stretching himself. "Katyusha, is it you?" "Come in," said he. She opened the door.
"Dinner is ready," she said.
She still had on the same white dress, but not the bow in her hair. She looked at him with a smile, as if she had communicated some very good news to him. "I'm coming," he answered, as he rose, taking his comb to arrange his hair. She stood still for a minute, and he, noticing it, threw down his comb and made a step towards her. But at that very moment she turned suddenly and went with quick, light steps along the strip of carpet in the middle of the passage. "Dear me! What a fool I am," thought Nekhludov. "Why did I not stop her?" What he wanted her for he did not know himself, but he felt that when she came into his room something should have been done, something that is generally done on such occasions, and that he had left it undone. "Katyusha, wait," he said.
"What do you want?"
she said, stopping.
"Nothing, only..."
And with an effort, remembering how men in his position generally behave, he put his arm round her waist. She stood still and looked into his eyes.
"Don't, Dmitri Ivanovitch, you must not," she said, blushing to tears and pushing away his arm with her strong, hard hand.
Nekhludov let her go, and for a moment he felt not only confused and ashamed, but disgusted with himself. He should now have believed himself, and then he would have known that this confusion and shame were caused by the best feelings of his soul demanding to be set free, but he thought it was only his stupidity, and that he ought to behave as everyone else did. He caught her up and kissed her on the neck. This kiss was very different from that first thoughtless kiss behind the lilac bush, and very different to the kiss this morning in the churchyard. This was a dreadful kiss, and she felt it.
"Oh! What are you doing?"
she cried, in a tone as if he had irreparably broken something of priceless value, and ran quickly away. He came into the dining-room. His aunts, elegantly dressed, their family doctor, and a neighbour were already there. Everything seemed so very ordinary. But in Nekhludov a storm was raging. He understood nothing of what was being said, and gave wrong answers, thinking only of Katyusha. The sound of her steps in the passage brought back the thrill of that last kiss, and he could think of nothing else. When she came into the room, he, without looking round, felt her presence with his whole being, and had to force himself not to look at her. After dinner he at once went into his bedroom, and for a long time walked up and down in great excitement, listening to every sound in the house and expecting to hear her steps. The animal man inside him had now not only lifted its head, but had succeeded in trampling underfoot the spiritual man of the days of his first visit, and even of that very morning. That dreadful animal man alone now ruled over him. Though he was watching for her all day, he could not manage to meet her alone. She was probably trying to evade him. In the evening, however, she was obliged to go into the room next to his. The doctor had been asked to stay the night, and she had to make his bed. When he heard her go in, Nekhludov followed her, treading softly, and holding his breath as if he were going to commit a crime. She was putting a clean pillowcase on the pillow, holding it by two of its corners with her arms inside the pillowcase. She turned round and smiled, not a happy, joyful smile as before, but in a frightened, piteous way. The smile seemed to tell him that what he was doing was wrong. He stopped for a moment. There was still the possibility of a struggle,
The voice of his real love for her, though feebly, was still speaking of her, her feelings, her life. Another voice was saying, "Take care I don't let the opportunity for your own happiness, your own enjoyment, slip by." And this second voice completely stifled the first. He went up to her with determination, and a terrible, ungovernable animal passion took possession of him. With his arm round, he made her sit down on the bed, and feeling that there was something more to be done, he sat down beside her.
"Dmitri Ivanovitch, dear, please let me go," she said with a piteous voice. "Matryona Pavlovna is coming," she cried, tearing herself away.
Someone was really coming to the door.
"Well, then, I'll come to you in the night," he whispered. "You'll be alone?"
"What are you thinking of? On no account, no, no," she said, but only with her lips.
The tremulous confusion of her whole being said something very different. It was Matryona Pavlovna who had come to the door. She came in with a blanket over her arm, looked reproachfully at Nekhludov, and began scolding Katyusha for having taken the wrong blanket. Nekhludov went out in silence, but he did not even feel ashamed. He could see by Matryona Pavlovna's face that she was blaming him. He knew that she was blaming him with reason, and felt that he was doing wrong. But this novel, low animal excitement, having freed itself of all the old feelings of real love for Katyusha, ruled supreme, leaving room for nothing else. He went about as if demented all the evening, now into his aunt's, then back into his own room, then out into the porch, thinking all the time how he could meet her alone. But she avoided him, and Matryona Pavlovna watched her closely. Chapter 17. Nekhludov and Katyusha. And so the evening passed, and night came. The doctor went to bed. Nekhludov's aunts had also retired, and he knew that Matryona Pavlovna was now with them in their bedroom, so that Katyusha was sure to be alone in the maid's sitting room. He again went out into the porch. It was dark, damp, and warm out of doors, and that white spring mist which drives away the last snow, or is diffused by the thawing of the last snow, filled the air. From the river under the hill, about 100 steps from the front door, came a strange sound. It was the ice breaking. Nekhludov came down the steps and went up to the window of the maid's room, stepping over the puddles on the bits of glazed snow. His heart was beating so fiercely in his breast that he seemed to hear it. His laboured breath came and went in a burst of long-drawn sighs. In the maid's room a small lamp was burning, and Katyusha sat alone by the table, looking thoughtfully in front of her. Nekhludov stood a long time without moving, and waited to see what she, not knowing that she was observed, would do. For a minute or two she did not move. Then she lifted her eyes, smiled, and shook her head as if chiding herself, then changed her pose and dropped both her arms on the table, and again began gazing down in front of her. He stood and looked at her, involuntarily listening to the beating of his own heart and the strange sounds from the river. There on the river, beneath the white mist, the unceasing labour went on, and sounds as of something sobbing, cracking, dropping, being shattered to pieces, mixed with the tinkling of the thin bits of ice as they broke against each other like glass. There he stood, looking at Katyusha's serious, suffering face, which betrayed the inner struggle of her soul, and he felt pity for her. But, strange though it may seem, this pity only confirmed him in his evil intention. He knocked at the window. She started as if she had received an electric shock. Her whole body trembled, and a look of horror came into her face. Then she jumped up, approached the window, and brought her face up to the pane. The look of terror did not leave her face even when, holding her hands up to her eyes like blinkers and peering through the glass, she recognized him. Her face was unusually grave. He had never seen it so before. She returned his smile, but only in submission to him. There was no smile in her soul. Only fear. He beckoned her with his hand to come out into the yard to him, but she shook her head and remained by the window. He brought his face close to the pane and was going to call out to her, but at that moment she turned to the door. Evidently someone inside had called her. Nekhludov moved away from the window. The fog was so dense that 5 steps from the house the windows could not be seen, but the light from the lamp shone red and huge out of a shapeless black mass. And on the river the same strange sounds went on, sobbing and rustling and cracking and tinkling. Somewhere in the fog, not far off, a cock crowed. Another answered, and then others, far in the village, took up the cry, till the sound of the crowing blended into one, while all around was silent excepting the river. It was the second time the cocks crowed that night. Nyakyudov walked up and down behind the corner of the house, and once or twice got into a puddle, then again came up to the window. The lamp was still burning, and she was again sitting alone by the table, as if uncertain what to do. He had hardly approached the window when she looked up. He knocked. Without looking who it was, she at once ran out of the room, and he heard the outside door open with a snap. He waited for her near the side porch and put his arms round her without saying a word. She clung to him, put up her face, and met his kiss with her lips. Then the door again gave the same sort of snap and opened, and the voice of Matryona Pavlovna called out angrily, "Katusha!" She tore herself away from him, and returned into the maid's room. He heard the latch click, and then all was quiet. The red light disappeared, and only the mist remained, and the bustle on the river went on. Nyakyudov went up to the window. Nobody was to be seen. He knocked, but got no answer. He went back into the house by the front door, but could not sleep. He got up and went with bare feet along the passage to her door, next Matryona Pavlovna's room. He heard Matryona Pavlovna snoring quietly, and was about to go on when she coughed and turned on her creaking bed, and his heart fell, and he stood immovable for about 5 minutes. When all was quiet, and she began to snore peacefully again, he went on, trying to step on the boards that did not creak, and came to Katyusha's door. There was no sound to be heard. She was probably awake, or else he would have heard her breathing. But as soon as he had whispered, "Katyusha," she jumped up and began to persuade him as if angrily to go away. "Open! Let me in just for a moment, I implore you!" He hardly knew what he was saying. When she left him, trembling and silent, giving no answer to his words, he again went out into the porch and stood trying to understand the meaning of what had happened. It was getting lighter. From the river below the creaking and tinkling and sobbing of the breaking ice came still louder, and a gurgling sound could now also be heard. The mist had begun to sink, and from above it the waning moon dimly lighted up something black and weird. What was the meaning of it all? Was it a great joy or a great misfortune that had befallen him? He asked himself. Chapter 18. Afterwards. The next day the gay, handsome, and brilliant Schonbock joined Nekhludov at his aunt's house, and quite won their hearts by his refined and amiable manner, his high spirits, his generosity, and his affection for Dmitri. But though the old ladies admired his generosity, it rather perplexed them, for it seemed exaggerated. He gave a rouble to some blind beggars who came to the gate, gave 15 rubles in tips to the servants, and when Sofia Ivanovna's pet dog hurt his paw and it bled, he tore his hem-stitched cambric handkerchief into strips. Sofia Ivanovna knew that such handkerchiefs cost at least 15 rubles a dozen, and bandaged the dog's foot. The old ladies had never met people of this kind, and did not know that Schonbock owed 200,000 rubles, which he was never going to pay, and that therefore 25 rubles, more or less, did not matter a bit to him. Schonbock stayed only one day, and he and Nyakyudov both left at night. They could not stay away from their regiment any longer, for their leave was fully up. At the stage which Nyakyudov's selfish mania had now reached, he could think of nothing but himself. He was wondering whether his conduct, if found out, would be blamed much or at all, but he did not consider what Katyusha was now going through and what was going to happen to her. He saw that Schonbock guessed his relations to her, and this flattered his vanity. "Ah, I see how it is you have taken such a sudden fancy to your aunts that you have been living nearly a week with them," Schonbock remarked when he had seen Katyusha. "Well, I don't wonder. I should have done the same. She's charming." Nekhludov was also thinking that though it was a pity to go away before having fully gratified the cravings of his love for her, yet the absolute necessity of parting had its advantages, because it put a sudden stop to relations it would have been very difficult for him to continue. Then he thought that he ought to give her some money. Not for her, not because she might need it, but because it was the thing to do. So he gave her what seemed to him a liberal amount, considering his and her station. On the day of his departure, after dinner, he went out and waited for her at the side entrance. She flushed up when she saw him and wished to pass by, directing his attention to the open door of the maid's room by a look. But he stopped her. "I have come to say goodbye," he said, crumbling in his hand an envelope with a 100-ruble note inside. "There, I—" She guessed what he meant, knit her brows, and, shaking her head, pushed his hand away. "Take it! Oh, you must!" he stammered, and thrust the envelope into the bib of her apron and ran back to his room, groaning and frowning as if he had hurt himself. And for a long time he went up and down, writhing as in pain, and even stamping and groaning aloud as he thought of this last scene. "But what else could I have done? Is it not what happens to everyone? And if everyone does the same, well, I suppose it can't be helped." In this way he tried to get peace of mind, but in vain. The recollection of what had passed burned his conscience. In his soul, in the very depths of his soul, he knew that he had acted in a base, cruel, cowardly manner, and that the knowledge of this act of his must prevent him not only from finding fault with anyone else, but even from looking straight into other people's eyes, not to mention the impossibility of considering himself a splendid, noble, high-minded fellow, as he did and had to do, to go on living his life boldly and merrily. But there was only one solution of the problem, i.e., not to think about it. He succeeded in doing so. The life he was now entering upon, the new surroundings, new friends, the war, all helped him to forget. And the longer he lived, the less he thought about it, until at last he forgot it completely. Once only, when, after the war, he went to see his aunts in hopes of meeting Katyusha, and heard that soon after his last visit she had left, and that his aunts had heard she had been confined somewhere or other, and had gone quite to the bad, his heart ached. According to the time of her confinement, the child might or might not have been his. His aunts said she had gone wrong, that she had inherited her mother's depraved nature, and he was pleased to hear this opinion of his aunts. It seemed to acquit him. At first he thought of trying to find her and her child, but then, just because in the depths of his soul he felt so ashamed and pained when thinking about her, he did not make the necessary effort to find her, but tried to forget his sin again and ceased to think about it. And now this strange coincidence brought it all back to his memory, and demanded from him the acknowledgment of the heartless, cruel cowardice which had made it possible for him to live these 9 years with such a sin on his conscience. But he was still far from such an acknowledgment, and his only fear was that everything might now be found out, and that she or her advocate might recount it all, and put him to shame before every one present. Chapter 19. The Trial. Resumption. In this state of mind, Nekhludov left the court and went into the jurymen's room. He sat by the window, smoking all the while, and hearing what was being said around him. The merry merchant seemed with all his heart to sympathize with Smelkov's way of spending his time.
"There, old fellow, that was something like real Siberian fashion. He knew what he was about, no fear. That's the sort of wench for me."
The foreman was stating his conviction that in some way or other the expert's conclusions were the important thing. Peter Gerasimovich was joking about something with a Jewish clerk, and they burst out laughing. Nekhludov answered all the questions addressed to him in monosyllables, and longed only to be left in peace. When the usher, with his sideways gait, called the jury back to the court, Nekhludov was seized with fear, as if he were not going to judge, but to be judged. In the depth of his soul he felt that he was a scoundrel, who ought to be ashamed to look people in the face, yet, by sheer force of habit, he stepped on to the platform in his usual self-possessed manner, and sat down, crossing his legs and playing with his pince-nez. The prisoners had also been led out and were now brought in again. There were some new faces in the court witnesses, and Nyakludov noticed that Maslova could not take her eyes off a very fat woman who sat in the row in front of the grating, very showily dressed in silk and velvet, a high hat with a large bow on her head, and an elegant little reticule on her arm, which was bare to the elbow. This was, as he subsequently found out, one of the witnesses, the mistress of the establishment to which Maslova had belonged. The examination of the witnesses commenced. They were asked their names, religion, etc. Then, after some consultation as to whether the witnesses were to be sworn in or not, the old priest came in again, dragging his legs with difficulty, and, again arranging the golden cross on his breast, swore the witnesses and the expert in the same quiet manner, and with the same assurance that he was doing something useful and important. The witnesses, having been sworn, all but Kitaeva, the keeper of the house, were led out again. She was asked what she knew about this affair. Kitaeva nodded her head and the big hat at every sentence, and smiled affectedly. She gave a very full and intelligent account, speaking with a strong German accent. First of all, the hotel servant Simeon, whom she knew, came to her establishment on behalf of a rich Siberian merchant, and she sent Lubov back with him. After a time, Lubov returned with the merchant. The merchant was already somewhat intoxicated. She smiled as she said this, and went on drinking and treating the girls. He was short of money. He sent this same Lubov to his lodgings. He had taken a predilection to her. She looked at the prisoner as she said this. Nekhludov thought he saw Maslova smile here, and this seemed disgusting to him. A strange, indefinite feeling of loathing mingled with suffering arose in him.
"And what was your opinion of Maslova?"
asked the blushing and confused applicant for a judicial post, appointed to act as Maslova's advocate.
"Ze very pesht," answered Kitaeva. "Ze young woman is educated and elegant. She was brought up in a good family and can read French. She did have a trop too much sometimes, but never forgot herself. A very good girl."
Katyusha looked at the woman, then suddenly turned her eyes on the jury and fixed them on Nekhludov. And her face grew serious and even severe. One of her serious eyes squinted, and those two strange eyes for some time gazed at Nekhludov, who, in spite of the terrors that seized him, could not take his look off these squinting eyes with their bright, clear whites. He thought of that dreadful night with its mist, the ice breaking on the river below, and when the waning moon, with horns turned upwards, that had risen towards morning, lit up something black and weird. These two black eyes now looking at him reminded him of this weird black something. "She has recognized me," he thought, and Nekhludov shrank as if expecting a blow, but she had not recognized him. She sighed quietly and again looked at the president. Nekhludov also sighed. "Oh, if it would only get on quicker!" he thought. He now felt the same loathing and pity and vexation as when, out shooting, he was obliged to kill a wounded bird. The wounded bird struggles in the game bag. One is disgusted and yet feels pity, and one is in a hurry to kill the bird and forget it. Such mixed feelings filled Nekhludov's breast as he sat listening to the examination of the witnesses.